Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Remember me? I haven't been on in such a long time. I forgot where the microphone is. I've been preempted for many weeks, and I am back, and I'm happy to be back here for the holiday season. It's all decorated here at the studio, and it's starting to look a little festive. And we have a little bit of a pre-Thanksgiving show for you with some topics that might interest you, considering that Thanksgiving's right around the corner. At 7:30, we're going to be talking about shopping. And what we're going to be talking about is the addiction to shopping that some people have. They say that 6 or 7% of all Americans have a serious addiction to overspending, compulsive spending, and impulse buying. And this time of the year is a very serious time for people to engage in that behavior. And not just, we're going to be talking about that addiction, but along the lines of other addictions and what you can do during the holiday season, try to nip these things in the bud and try to kind of contain yourself, whether it's addiction to overeating or addiction to certain behaviors that are just not healthy, but using shopping kind of as the springboard to have that conversation. And of course, if you've ever listened to the show before, you know that I am a practicing lawyer. I've been practicing law for over 33 years. And at the 8 o'clock hour, I will be taking your legal questions. Any question you might have about anything, you'll be calling me here or texting me at the 312-981-7200 number, 312-981-7200. Put that in your speed dial. And if you have any questions at all about anything you've been watching in the news, we're not getting political, but I can explain some things. If you would like me to define some terms or explain what's going on, I'll do my best. There's Jussie Smollett in the news again, of course, if you want to weigh in on that. But if you have any just garden variety legal questions, I'm here to answer those too. And I'm probably going to weigh in a little bit on travel, some travel legal rights, because a lot of you I know will be traveling. This week is a big travel week. And I'm going to be maybe talking about what happens when your flight is canceled. Just happened to me. I waited 8 hours in the airport. They finally canceled the flight. And what happens? What are your legal rights? What happens when they lose your luggage? What about rental cars? Should you get that extra insurance? And timeshare. That's the big one. People call me all the time. How can I get out of my timeshare? Should I buy one? Are these a good deal? I want to weigh in on that and talk about it along with your legal questions. So we got a great show. Stay tuned. Let's get right into our topic. Our first topic is, you know, Thanksgiving is coming. We have all of our relatives there. We have the perfect storm. We have relatives. We have alcohol. And we're coming off of the impeachment hearings. I mean, we're not going to have impeachment hearings this week, which is good. But I think people are so polarized. People are so politically polarized on these issues. And I fear, and I think a lot of family members fear, what happens when you sit down to Thanksgiving dinner and you start the argument? Or should you talk politics? Is it something that you should do? Is it something that you should just stay away from us? And joining us to talk about this topic is Lee Richardson, a licensed professional counselor and the owner of the Brain Performance Center. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This is a great topic. I saw, Lee, that this past Wednesday, at UC Berkeley, conservative political commentator was scheduled to talk, and she did, and there were hundreds of arrests, and people are screaming and yelling. She had been scheduled before, and it was canceled. Ann Coulter was the one I'm talking about. And it just seems to me that we are so on edge and that we are so much more personally ingrained in the political conversation. Is that true or is that just our perception?
No, I think it's very true because our political awareness has been intensified in the last 4 years where, you know, Twitter's going wild and news is coming at us 24/7. And now we have fake news that we have to deal with.
I think 30 years ago, we were always, you know, there would be Democrats at the table, Republicans at the table. People would be very, maybe opinionated about things, but nothing like this. It seems like it crosses into the realm of personal, sort of like, you know, if you don't like Trump, I don't like you, or vice versa. If you like Trump, I don't like you. Where does this come from? Can you give a little explanation?
You know, you make a really good point. Used to be it was very clear what our stance was. And when you look at the Generation Z, and that is the next generation that is reaching the voting age, and they're united on some of the topics that have always divided the United States, like climate change, legalizing marijuana, and social issues. But what's so interesting to me is I saw a survey in Business Insider, and that reports that the majority of them, they do not identify as either conservative or liberal. They're not saying I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican. That complicates things.
Let's take a break here. I'm sorry, we're gonna go right to break here. And when we come back, I want to talk more about this topic. And then I think what I would like to do is I'd like to have a little role play here. And we're gonna sit down to Thanksgiving dinner, and we're gonna see what happens. And we're gonna ask Lee Richardson to help us weigh in on how to stop a fight at the dinner table. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Let's go back to our topic with Lee Richardson. We're talking about politics at the dinner table. Lee, you mentioned that there was a poll, and the Gen Z people? Is that what you call them?
Yes.
These are the youngest, are saying that they don't identify with either party. So if that is the case, then why are we so polarized, and why are the college campuses so almost violent when it comes to people who have opinions that they don't agree with?
Well, yeah, I think that there's all this neurodiversity, and that's a new term in my world. And we're all trying to form our own opinion. And I think it boils down to we have so much information coming at us 24/7, and it makes it hard. And there's the whole fake news. It makes it hard to really understand what we're processing. And when you stop and think about how you process information, it's all done on a subconscious level. It's not done consciously.
Well, you know, I guess I feel like when I was a kid, we'd watch the news, and I'm not saying it wasn't skewed a little bit one way or the other, but they tried very hard not to do that. They tried to make sure that, like, you probably heard the advertisement with Walter Jacobson. Walter Jacobson is a newscaster here in Chicago who was on the air for 40 years, and he would read the news, but when he did his editorial, he would actually go into a new room, he would take off his coat, he put on his suspenders, and it was a whole different thing, because we knew this was his opinion, not the opinion of the station or based upon the facts. But here and now, we turn on CNN, and it's both ways. We get people who are eye-rolling and making fun of things and skewing things, and you turn on Fox, and it's going the other way. And people, I think, just tune into what they want to hear. I think I kind of feel like that's what people do. Is that part of it?
Well, I think people like drama, you know. The more dramatic you make it, the more eye-rolling you get going, that catches the attention. That engages them. I think, you know, in the old school, we could disagree without drama.
Right. That's my exact point. Like, why can't we just disagree without drama? I mean, I have seen people sitting in restaurants and sitting at bars and sitting on buses, and they start talking, and it starts out as a nice conversation, and you see people walk up and get away because they don't want to hear someone say, I don't like Donald Trump, or they don't want to hear someone say, I don't like Elizabeth Warren, or whatever it is. Instead of just saying, why is it that you feel that way, and I don't feel that way, I beg to differ, but I respect your opinion, it's just... it's run away. Almost fist to cuffs.
Well, you know, I think it's just getting harder and harder for us to keep our mind open and listen to other point of views. You don't have to agree with them, but truly the beauty of conversation is in listening.
So if you want to be a better listener, and I thought, let's just say that I don't want to get angry with somebody whose opinion that I don't agree with, okay? Because I'm up there too. I'm doing the same thing. If I start hearing people talk about how horrible one person is and how this person committed murders and their wife was unfaithful, and yet my candidate is so perfect and he did everything right or she did everything wrong, what do I do? How do I program my brain to ignore the part of it that really angers me about that conversation?
Well, my advice is, you know, you can either laugh or cry. to use humor. You know, make a statement. Okay, let's all calm our inner warriors before we go into this conversation. And laugh about it. And take that intensity down a notch or two.
Yeah, I suppose. But I guess I feel like if I laugh at something someone says, they're going to get even more angry with me, thinking that I make so little of what their opinion is that I'm laughing at it. But, so let's just say we're all thinking about going to our Thanksgiving dinner, and we know we have a diverse group of people with diverse opinions. What do you think, Lee? Do you think we should just stay away from politics? Is that just the best thing and the safest thing to do? Or is there any way to organize it or to create rules that will not lead to carving knives doing some harm?
Well, we don't want to take any victims, that's for sure. So I think, you know, as a hostess or a host, be prepared. You know, have a few conversational starters in mind. So when you can see that conversation starting to go Dixie, you know, it's so interesting that everyone has a different part of view, but I'd like to talk about this. I'd like to engage everybody at the table to, you know, come together and let's talk about this.
And so that being what? That not being politics, that being something else?
That being, you know your family, you know your friends, you know what they're interested in. Are they interested in social and cultural events? Chicago, you guys got stuff happening every minute. You know, what's new? What's exciting? What have you done? What have you seen? What are they interested in? How can you reframe and divert their thoughts?
That's really good, because there's a lot to talk about. And here's what we're going to do. Lee Richardson, thank you for joining me. We are talking a little bit about how to avoid the problems at Thanksgiving dinner relating to political speak. Lee Richardson's a licensed professional counselor with the Brain Performance Center. And I'm going to have my husband, Jerry, we're going to do a little mock sitting down at the Thanksgiving dinner table. We're going to play it out. We didn't rehearse this, so Jerry's looking at me like, what I'm doing now. And I want you to break it down, Lee, as to where this went wrong, okay?
Okay.
All right, here
Let's
we go.
Go.
All right, and I guess I'm hosting the dinner, and my Uncle George is coming to the table. Hi, Uncle George. It's so nice to see you.
Hey, little Karen. How are you?
Hey, I'm not so little anymore. Uncle George.
You'll always be little to me. Plus the fact, I know you're a liberal and a vegan, so you must be little,
at least
in your mind.
Wait a minute. I'm going to eat the cranberry sauce. I'm going to eat the mashed potatoes, but so I'm vegan. You know, you can't change that about me.
Well, I think we should sue Burger King for cooking those vegan burgers on the same grill.
Well, that I agree with you. That's a stupid lawsuit, and I'm a lawyer, and I can say that, right?
Hey, you been watching that impeachment stuff?
Well, as a matter of fact, I have, Uncle George.
Yeah, I've not been watching it at all because I can give you my breakdown of the whole thing.
Well, you know, maybe we're going to just keep away from that tonight,
Well, you'll like my summary of everything they said. Here it is. Blah, 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 yada, yada, blah, blah.
So you don't think it's that important that we have a president who's doing this kind of stuff? Do you really? I mean, really? Asking to investigate your political enemies in exchange for aid to the country? Really?
Nothing's been proven. It's all hearsay.
Okay, hearsay.
This is why I break this down right
okay.
now. At the table, you know, you've got young kids sitting at the table, and you can see Uncle George getting a little rowdy over there. And Aunt Karen, you don't know what she's going to do when he gets rowdy. Well, I was just saying, isn't this interesting that everybody has a different point of view? And children, it is so respectful to listen to those points of view and just keep your mind open. You don't have to agree or disagree. Now, do we, Uncle George or Aunt Karen?
Well, yeah, I think it's a great idea to listen, but listen to me. Don't listen to him.
Well, he's nicer to me than you are.
No pumpkin pie for you, Ms. Richardson. No, but I mean, I can see that. I can see that happening at so many dinner tables. I just think there should be something on everyone's dinner table that says, we are not talking about it. We're just not going to. I mean, you know,
well, even, I think
go ahead.
We can even, you know, when we say our blessings and we say grace, and I'm so thankful for my family being together and this wonderful food we have in front of us, and I'm so thankful that Uncle George and Aunt Karen aren't going to engage in war. I mean, we have to acknowledge that it's there, and we have to laugh about it. I honestly believe that you can use humor to diffuse very many, many tense situations.
That's a very good idea, and I think we should all go with that. Lee Richardson, thank you so much for joining us. Lee Richardson is with the Brain Performance Center. How do we get a hold of you if we need you to moderate and mediate our Thanksgiving dinner?
Well, you can always find me online. I'm on LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook. Good old-fashioned website, thebrainperformancecenter.com.
Thank you so much. Take care and have a wonderful holiday. I wanted to tell everyone before I take a break that there is, the CDC just put out a warning about romaine lettuce. I just want to make sure everyone heard that, because I sat down to lunch today and they served me romaine lettuce, and that's a problem. All of it is bad. They're telling you to throw it away. There's a special E. coli that people are getting. Some of it is very serious with kidney failure, and even for older people and younger people, it might mean death. So if you have any romaine lettuce anywhere, anytime that you purchased anywhere, you need to get rid of it and throw it away and make sure you don't serve it to even to Uncle George at the Thanksgiving table. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. We were just talking about the Thanksgiving dinner table and whether people are going to be so politically charged in their conversations that it could ruin our holidays. And I had a really good insight from a 224 texter. We see this coming from the top, not disagreeing with an idea, but attacking on a personal level. Politics or politicians on many people's minds and affecting people's lives. I get it. We see this, you're absolutely right, where someone, instead of just saying, I don't agree with our president's this, he's a scumball, he's a jerk, or vice versa, the other way. Instead of parsing what the idea is and what the problem is with the idea, you're basically just saying the person is bad, so therefore everything coming out of his or her mouth has to be false. And that's interesting. As an attorney, you know, I argue in court all the time, and that's something that you just don't do. When you're sitting there arguing a motion, or you're arguing to a jury, you're trying to convince people of your position, you don't attack the other side. You don't attack the person, either the attorney or the party. You try to be as rational as you can. You try to come up with the reasoning and the intelligent, well-reasoned argument, rather than don't listen to that person because he's got a bad attitude, or he's coming from the wrong place, or he's dishonest, or what have you. Arguments should get won based upon rational thought and facts that that we can all agree on. Thank you for that text message. Now, another issue with the holiday season upon us, Black Friday is coming soon. There's going to be a lot of shopping all throughout this season. And, you know, for some people, you know, they don't like shopping, but they have to shop for their friends and their family, and they do it, and they do what they need to do, and they're done with it. But some people are overdo it. Some people are addicted, much like people are addicted to food. You know, we all have to eat, we all have to shop, but some people just overdo it. A recent study that came out showed that 1 in 20 adults have developed an addiction to shopping. Buying shopping disorder, BSD, is characterized by extreme preoccupations with and craving for buying and shopping, and by irresistible and identity-seeking urges to possess consumer goods. That's a heck of a lot of words to mean you shop too much. And with us to discuss shopping addiction is Melissa Caldwell Engel. Melissa is a licensed professional counselor with over 25 years of experience treating addictions. She's the clinical director and co-founder of the Healing Springs Ranch, an internationally recognized residential treatment for adults recovering from addiction. Hello, Melissa. How are you?
Just fine.
Now, a lot of people roll their eyes about this and they say, oh, now this is an addiction. Oh, sex addiction. Oh, computer addiction. How real is it to say that people have a shopping addiction?
Well, it's real enough that it destroys people's lives and breaks up families and causes all kinds of problems for folks. So it's just as real as substance use.
And, you know, as an attorney and a family law lawyer, Melissa, I see this all the time where I have one party who likes to go out and spend on things and the other party's working and trying to save and kids need to go to college and one party is off and there's tags on everything in the closet because he or she hasn't worn them. And it causes breakdowns of the marriage. Money is number one. Spending money is number one reason why marriages break up, according to the research that I've seen. So I agree with you. Can you tell me what are some of the bullet points for people who you think can say, like, okay, I have this addiction?
Well, some of the behavioral things you would see would be, just like you mentioned, if they have a lot of stuff in their closet that still has the tags on it or still in the bag, buying stuff you don't really need, getting kind of overly excited when you buy. Quite often afterwards they'll feel remorse and try to rationalize their buying, or they'll hide their shopping bags. They'll be anxious if they're not able to shop that day, and they can't seem to stop even when they know there's a lot of negative consequences. So those are some of the hallmarks of the behaviors that you can see. But the underlying issue is that addictive pattern fills an emptiness and a void and probably a sense of not being worthy or having value within the person themselves. That's the underlying root of it.
So if you, is it the addiction to the actual going out and buying, or is it the addiction of having things and, you know, having a wardrobe full of clothing and shoes? Or is it kind of both, or depends on the person?
It's both. I mean, it can be, some people it's just the process. It's almost like, for some people, the shopping is about finding things on sale, getting them very inexpensive, even if they don't need them. And I kind of joke about it. It's like I'll tease with the men. I'll say, it's like when you go out and you wait and you wait and you wait for that perfect buck to shoot. For women, they wait and they wait and they wait for the perfect sale. But it takes on very much of an addictive nature when they don't even need it.
And so you say this, and if you have any questions or if you have any comments or if anyone out there knows somebody who has this problem and you'd like to ask a question here of Melissa, please give us a call at 981-7200, 312-981-7200. Is kind of off the topic just a little bit, but is there such thing as an addictive personality? I've heard that where someone says, you know, I can get addicted to all different things, whether it's, I start decorating for Christmas and I can't stop. I'm on the computer. I can't get off the computer. Is this something that there is such a thing?
It's not a formal diagnosis, but are there people that have many, many addictive patterns? Absolutely. And if you don't deal with the underlying core root, like I was kind of mentioning earlier, if there's any kind of childhood trauma, if there's feelings of insecurity or worthlessness or poor self-esteem, and you're looking for an external solution to an internal problem, it's real easy to focus on as many different external solutions as you can. And some people will stop drinking, and they'll say, you know, I've been clean and sober for 10 years, but they have this horrible gambling problem or this horrible shopping
yes.
problem, or they start smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. So it'll substitute if you don't deal with the underlying core root.
Interesting. And that's what I see a lot. And you, what you're saying is you could solve one problem and it just kind of morphs into something else without attacking the core part of it. And when you talk about an addiction like to drugs or to alcohol or to smoking, let's say, there's a component of that that is physically addictive in a way that maybe computer addiction is not, or shopping is not. Is there a difference? Can you parse it that way, or is it all kind of part and parcel of the same thing?
Well, a lot of people will talk about, you know, there's certain drugs, alcohol, you have to go through a detox process and you're going to have physiological reactions, whereas like with marijuana, you may not. But whether you go through a physiological addiction and your body is addicted chemically to it, once you get the chemicals out of your system, the emotional addiction or the mental addiction, the pleasure center of the brain, that part of the brain that lights up with the excitement and the way that those feelings are experienced in the body is the same as what we call process addictions. And what you're describing is a process addiction, when you're addicted to a process. So if it's gambling, shopping, pornography, sex, codependency, eating disorders, people get addicted to the processes. And interestingly enough, it affects the brain in the same way in regard to the pleasure center or the reward center in your brain.
I know that you have written about computer issues, and I think a lot of counselors and a lot of people are talking about how that is changing people. Can you just describe a little bit how the fact that we're all on computers all the time, looking at social media, shopping online, you know, messaging people, how is this affecting us long term? Again, I'm sure we don't know yet because we're not there, but is this affecting these kinds of addictions?
Oh, absolutely. And we're starting to see some of the research that comes out with it. A big piece of it is when you're dealing with someone who has addictive patterns, like what we're talking about, who already has poor impulse control, to be able to have the secrecy and kind of hide in your own home and nobody has to know, and secrecy is part of the addictive pattern, it just makes that so much easier. And people are able to do this so much quicker. I mean, it takes less effort to go push a button on a computer than it does to get in your car, drive downtown, go to the stores. So it really kind of helps to create that little secretive bubble around the person that struggles with the addiction.
So if you have this problem, or if you know somebody who has this problem, or you see someone maybe sliding into that issue, what are the things, obviously you're going to say to go get counseling to deal with that underlying problem, that feeling of worthlessness or the feeling of insecurity or void that you might have, but what are some of the things that you can do from an external standpoint to stop this behavior?
Other than counseling and kind of getting to the core issue, if you just want to focus on kind of a behavioral structure, you could, like, you know, make sure you have a budget, have someone that works with you, have someone help you manage your money, make sure that maybe you don't go shopping alone. It's kind of like any parameters with any other, like with drinking or other addictive cycles. You don't want to put yourself in situations where you can act on something impulsively. So you're going to want to have support around that and build parameters to protect yourself from yourself if you're just going to address the behavior. If you want to address the underlying issue and get to what is driving this and causing this, that's ideal.
And what do you think about children on their computers? There's a lot of parents out there and grandparents out there. What are some of the parameters that maybe, you know, I know you're a parent yourself, and, I'd like to hear from your standpoint, how are you dealing with these kids being on the phone, being on their computers all the time? I think there was a stat that said that college women are on their phone or their computer 10 hours a day during college. I don't know if that's true, but I read that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's not surprised me, but that's
yeah.
Scary.
So what do you say to your kids, and what kind of rules do you make?
The research is kind of changing. It's continuing to grow and change, and it's pretty scary. This is probably a whole nother show we could have on this
one,
because it's very upcoming. It's very scary. What we're learning now is, when I was growing up, the exciting game we got to all play was called Pong. I don't know if anybody remembers
that. Oh,
yes,
yeah.
But you could be both players and have time to go to the kitchen and get something to eat before the ball would get back to the other side of the screen, right? So it was a very slow-paced game. What they're showing now is that the actual frequency of lights, the flickering, the colors, and the speed and how rapid the movements are, it's actually affecting children's developing brains. So this is really pretty scary. This is affecting people at a physiological level, and it's affecting the development of their brain.
And so what would you say to parents? What should the rules be? I know it depends, but what would you say to your kids? Is there a number of hours a day that they can be on their phones? Do you put it aside at night for a certain amount of time?
Definitely with the games that the kids are playing, they were saying at one point in time no more than 30 minutes a day. Now they're saying no more than an hour a week.
So it's changing.
It's changing. And it depends on what they're playing and what they're doing. But a lot of these very fast games that the most addictive, oh, this is the part that's really scary too, they used to say that the most addictive drug was methamphetamines. Then they said when you measure the excitability of the brain, methamphetamines is the strongest. Then they show that pornography trumps methamphetamine when you look at the excitability on the brain.
Oh, my goodness.
Now what they're saying, now what trumps pornography and methamphetamine is the non-ending games that these kids play.
Wow.
So our kids are at the highest level of excitability and addiction on the brain with the games that they play at the age of 7. So it's like, what's left for these poor kids?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much, Melissa Caldwell-Engel. Where can people reach you if they would like to discuss this further?
At healing Springs Ranch, and that's in Tioga, Texas.
That sounds wonderful.
You can look.
Is it, so it's a place where people go and you treat them there?
Yes, ma'am. It is a treatment facility for people that struggle with addictive patterns, and they can look on our website. It talks all about it. And one thing we do different is we get to the core issue. We get to the core root that's driving these addictive cycles, whether it's chemical addiction or process addictions, which includes shopping. We help deal with the underlying core issue so the patterns themselves and the addictive personality stops.
Thank you so much. Melissa Caldwell-Engel, have a happy holiday.
You too.
All
Thank
right.
you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue talking about the holidays. We're going to talk about travel and your legal rights in the travel realm. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. And we're going to talk a little bit about the legal rights that you have when you travel, and if anyone has any questions, we're going to kind of start our legal questioning a little early tonight since I haven't been on the air. Let me give out the numbers again. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can text or give me a call here and we can chat. If for some reason you don't get to talk to me or you would like to talk in private, I can always try to answer your question or steer you in the right direction if you call my office or email my office. I'll give you that information as well. 312-332-7800, or you can email wgn@askkarenconti.com. And just so you know, I can't really give you specific legal advice without being retained. So, but what I try to do is I try to give you my best, you know, just opinion on how you should proceed or what you should be thinking about. Perhaps there's an agency that that would help you. Sometimes it's just a matter of saying, no, you don't really have a lawsuit, or referring you to somebody who might be able to help you out from a legal standpoint. So I'm always happy to do that. I spend, you know, a good amount of time during the day doing that. I'd probably spend, I'd say, a couple hours a week referring my WGN listeners to people and hoping that helping them get their legal problems taken care of to the best I can. So let's talk a little bit about the holidays and the travel and the legal rights attendant to that. And I had mentioned timeshare, and a 630 texter said, hello, did I hear you mentioned talking about timeshare? I'm looking for an exit timeshare and I'm leaving work. Can you text me or mention who I can contact? Let me just tell you this. I don't tell people what to do very often, but I would say I would never buy a timeshare. I just would never do it. I think people go on vacation. They fall in love with where they are. Sometimes these people, as you might have experienced, put pressure on you. They agree to give you a bottle of rum and they take you out to a place that's not quite finished yet. And they wine and dine you and they tell you how great this is and how cheap it is and how it's going to be gorgeous. And they get you in a mood and you buy. And you don't read the small print. And the small print is horrible. Some of these timeshares, and I'm not saying everyone has a bad experience with timeshares. I assume that there are people out there who enjoy their timeshares, and it's a good thing and it's a positive thing. But it's not something that you should sign without having an attorney look at it, because it has long-lasting consequences. You really can't get rid of them. You really can't do it. There's very few ways to get rid of a timeshare. And when you see these people who advertise, companies claim that they can sell the timeshare, or they can transfer the timeshare or donate them. Those are the things that they promise. It's probably not legitimate. And here's why. The timeshares, most of them are geared toward you have an obligation and then you have the right to the timeshare. But you can almost never get rid of the obligation. So yes, you could transfer the right to go to the timeshare to a charity, but you're not going to transfer the obligation. So you might still have to pay the monthly fees and whatever you're paying for, even if it's transferred to somebody else. And let's just say they transfer it to somebody else, that somebody else says, oh yeah, I'll pay it. What happens if they don't pay it? You're stuck with it. You're the one who's legally obligated, and they come after you and they file a lawsuit and they can get a judgment against you. So, you know, these things are very, very difficult. And the companies that supposedly do this, I'm just not convinced that they're very good. I've not seen one company handle one of these things and get rid of the timeshares. Not one. If you want to call me and tell me that you've had good experience with someone, you let me know. There is one that I have heard does a very good job. And again, this is just through the grapevine with lawyer friends of mine who have dealt with it. But there's a company called Sapphire Timeshare Cancellation. I believe it's down in Florida. And what they do is they try to approach it from, this is void because you didn't follow all the rules. So not that they're trying to cancel it, or they're trying to cancel it from the inception, saying that you timeshare people didn't follow the law and therefore the contract is void. And this doesn't always apply, and it has to be a certain fact pattern, but I do understand that they have been successful in some cases of breaking the timeshare. So again, best advice to you is don't do it. And if you really want to do it, you can wait until you go home. You can think about it. You can spend a couple weeks thinking about it, and you can have the paperwork in front of a lawyer and have an understanding of what it means. And sometimes, even after your death, there's obligations attendant to the timeshare. So be very, very careful. And I hope I can save at least one person the hassle of that. Let's talk about car rental. That's something that people ask me all the time. They ask me, when I go to the car rental agency, do I sign on for that extra insurance? Is that something that I really should do, or should I not do it? Generally speaking, you shouldn't have to do it. If you own a car, you have insurance yourself, and that covers you while you're in that rental car, meaning it covers you if you were to get into an accident and cause damage to somebody else. Your own insurance would cover that, okay? So it's probably not necessary to get coverage over and above that, as it would be duplicative. And sometimes the coverage that they want you to get is double what you're paying for the car rental. I mean, I've seen that where if you add up all the insurance they want to sell you, it's truly double and sometimes more than double what the car rental actually is. The car rental company itself is required to provide insurance, and that insurance is usually better than what the state mandates. So I believe the current amount is $50,000 in bodily injury and $100,000 for two or more people who are injured. I believe that I'm right about that. Sometimes it changes, but that's more than what you're required to have as a driver in Illinois. So their insurance is good, and you should be able to rely upon that. Also, if you're paying with certain credit cards, the credit card will provide certain insurance. So you should know if your American Express, for instance, has a program where if you're renting a car, it provides supplemental coverage over and above what the insurance already covers. Also, you should know if you're traveling on business that if you're traveling on business and get into an accident, it could be that your boss, your employer, has insurance that would cover you because you're transacting business and you're doing work in the course of business. Having an accident would be something that would be possibly covered by your employer. So you just need to know if you, if that's the case. So, again, I'm not saying that this is the be all end all and that's exactly what you should do, but that's the thought process that goes along with the car rental. This just happened to Jerry and me. We went to New Orleans, got to the airport coming home to Chicago, and we were told the airplane was going to be fixed, and it wasn't, and we were there 8 hours, and finally they canceled the flight. So what are your obligations? What are your rights when this happens? Well, you're entitled to get on the next possible flight, so they have to make sure that you get to your destination. It may not be that evening, but they have to take all efforts to try to get you on a flight to get you to your destination. There's also cash compensation. The law says that you are entitled to at least $1,350. Depending upon the length of the delay and the ticket price. But you can negotiate. You can negotiate for a seat on another plane or some points. But make sure you use them and make sure you know the restrictions, because most people who get points or they get a seat on the next plane, on some other plane or another trip, they usually don't use it. So make sure that you can actually fly and do that. So that's Travel 101. This is the Karen Conti Show. You're listening to WGN. It's time. It's time to get your legal questions in. Anything you want to talk about. something you saw in the news this week, not politics, but we can talk about the legal aspects of what you've read, questions that you have. I would like to get into a conversation with you. So give us a call here, 312-981-7200. It's a no political zone here. It's not allowed. We're not talking politics. We're talking legal things. And if you have some questions on anything that you might have, a family law issue, you have problems for the holidays, on visitation, child support, you have issues when it comes to travel. We were talking a little bit about travel. Give us a call, 981-7200. I had a texter. I was talking a little bit about what happens when your flight is canceled. If your flight is canceled, as I was talking about, due to the plane, there was a problem with the plane. It didn't have a communication system. They had to wait for a part. The part didn't come and all of that stuff. That's something to do with the airplanes, the airlines problem, and it was their fault. So therefore, there were different rights. If the flight is canceled due to weather, that is deemed to be an act of God, and therefore the airline really doesn't have very many obligations other than to try to get you on the next available flight as soon as they can, and or to get a refund of the portion of the flight that you weren't able to use because of the weather. But there's no money involved. There's no right to have a hotel paid for or any of those things. And, you know, generally, my theory when it comes to dealing with the airlines and these things is to be nice, because they really want to try to accommodate you, even though sometimes they're not very good at in a crisis mode. And it can be very frustrating dealing with some of the agents who are not really trained very well on how to deal with people who are trying to get home. They're trying to get on business. They've been waiting in the airport for 8 hours. It's obviously very stressful. But if you're nice to them and you tell them, you know, you need a hotel, is there some way you can put me up? They have deals with the hotels. They have food vouchers that they can give you. And hopefully you can negotiate something that will satisfy you and get you on your way as quickly as possible. The issue of lost luggage, that's another one that is a very common problem, obviously, when you're traveling. And just so you know, when you pack things like cameras and jewelry, or valuables like even cash. I don't know that anyone wants to put or thinks about putting cash or even like a stamp collection or a coin collection, anything of value or that has kind of antique value. You don't put that in your luggage because that is not going to be compensable once your luggage is lost or stolen. Basically, there's strict rules. If they lose your luggage, the airlines have to compensate you. The most they can compensate you is approximately $3,400. You have to keep all of the receipts of things that you buy. So if you make it to Florida and you need a bathing suit and you need suntan lotion and you need makeup, you are going to buy all those things. I wouldn't go expensive because they may have a limit on what they will pay you for certain things. So you may have to go to the drugstore and get your makeup rather than to the Estee Lauder counter or wherever expensive place you might otherwise go. And you keep good track and you keep track of what you need and what you have to buy. And if they find your bag, they have the obligation to bring it to your hotel. So don't think you have to go back to the airport. Their obligation is to immediately give it to you at your place where you're staying. And that's why that's very important when you make that claim initially to give them a very good address of where you're going to be and a good cell phone number, because they're going to want to get it out to you as soon as they can. And otherwise, like I said, you're going to keep receipts. You're going to put it together. Even if you need a suitcase, that is something that's compensable so that you can take your stuff home with you that you buy as a result of the bags being lost. Very frustrating, but knowing your rights ahead of time is always a good thing. No one's calling me. Got to call me, because we have, I'm here with phone lines open, 312-9 981-7200. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to answer your legal questions. This is the Karen Conti Show, a special pre-Thanksgiving Karen Conti Show on WGN. 981-7200. I'm taking your legal questions. I think we've got a couple calls coming in, so Ben is going to take them. In the meantime, I want to talk a little bit about a question that I got last week from a nice texter who said, do I have to work during the holidays? Can an employer force me to work? Can I be fired for not working during the holidays? What if I have a religious preference that says that I cannot work on religious holidays? Well, Yes, you have a right to have your religious beliefs honored. Title VII requires that the employer has an affirmative duty to reasonably accommodate the employees for religious observances, okay? And unless there's an undue hardship, that means they must give you the day off. Now, it doesn't mean Christmas Eve necessarily. It doesn't mean 5 days after Christmas. It might mean just that holiday, okay? And it has to be reasonable. And if it's super costly, if it's going to unburden, if it's going to overly burden other people in the workplace, or if there's a safety issue where it's going to grossly decrease efficiency at the workplace, the employer can override your religious belief and say, yes, you have to work at Christmas. So, and if you don't, can the employer fire you? Yes, the employer can fire you. Basically, you're an employee at will, meaning he can fire you for anything other than something that's discriminatory. And if it rises to that level that the accommodation is not reasonable, then they certainly can fire you for that. And they certainly don't have to pay you for giving you the day off. So if your boss gives you Thanksgiving off and that Friday afterwards, they do not have to pay you for it. If you look at your policy handbook, it may say that you do get pay, in which case there's a precedent set that the employer should pay you, but there's no legal requirement that you be paid for holidays. Let us go to Steve. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You have a comment about auto insurance while traveling.
Hi, Karen. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah. A little while ago, when you were talking about the auto insurance when you have a rental car, you're absolutely correct that your own auto policy will provide bodily injury and property damage for you. However, if you're traveling outside of the U.S. and Canada,
right, exactly,
you really need to buy other, you know, local automobile insurance because your own policy has an exclusion in it, you know, based on the territory.
You're right. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. You're absolutely right. And even if you go to a foreign country and you're driving the car, it could be that their own policy doesn't cover you when you cross country lines. So
exactly.
You got to really be careful about that. Thank you so much for that addition, because that's very, very important.
You're welcome.
All right, Steve. Take care and happy holidays to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Very good observation there. For instance, you know, Mexico. We're going to Mexico for Thanksgiving. I'm doing that just so I don't have to cook, just so you know. And definitely not going to get a car, but if I did get a car, you'd have to make sure that insurance is going to cover it, and probably wouldn't, so you would actually have to buy it and make sure you are covered. Thanks, Steve. Here's a question that came up a couple weeks ago. There was a CEO of a very large corporation who stepped down. He was having a relationship with somebody at work. They were both unmarried, but it was something that was forbidden by company policy, apparently, and he stepped down. And it was a significant issue because he was a very well-paid, highly respected CEO, and there's nothing wrong with that inherently, but in the workplace, that was a no-no. So the question is, is it illegal to date someone in the workplace? Can you be fired for it? What are your rights? You know, it's interesting because people spend a lot of time at work, right? Sometimes you spend more time at work than you do with your family and your husband and your significant loved ones. So it's a place that people meet, and they come to know each other, and sometimes dating does happen as a result of the workplace. So the question is this a problem? And it is a problem. I mean, there's nothing inherently illegal about dating someone in the workplace. But the first thing you probably want to do is to look at your policy handbook. And your policy handbook could say that you are prohibited from having a relationship with people in the workplace. And if that would certainly give the employer cause to fire you. And then really, truly, there's no, you don't have a lot of rights in the workplace anyway, other than not to be discriminated against based upon race and gender and sex and age. But dating someone, yeah, they could certainly fire you even if it's not in the policy handbook. But certainly if it is in the policy handbook, that's a big red flag. And so that would be the first thing that I would do. And here's the other problem is, if you are dating somebody who is your subordinate, say you're managing seven people and you're dating one of the people who you actually oversee, there is a problem that's very difficult to overcome in that situation, because if people know that you're dating somebody who's on their level and they see that maybe there's a perception that that person's getting advantages, gets to come in late a little bit, maybe is getting the plum assignments, maybe is getting a raise, and there's going to be some perception that because the boss is having a relationship with the underling, that there's a quid pro quo, meaning that if I want to get ahead in my job, I have to sleep with the boss. And even if it's that that's not true and the boss is treating everyone fairly, including the person that is you know, having the relationship, it creates a perception of unfairness. And what happens if there's a breakup? What happens if the boss then does something untoward and says, oh, okay, now I'm going to demote you, or I'm going to take away some of your perks now that you're not dating me? Certainly that is going to be something that is going to be suspect and could definitely run into a situation where there's a case for sexual discrimination and sexual harassment. So that's something that really, really needs to be looked at, and something that really needs to be considered. And perhaps the best thing to do is to find a way to maybe work outside of the realm and maybe go into another business, a side of the business where you're not actually working with them. Now, I'm supposed to give out the number here, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. I'm taking your legal questions. We've got lots of time here, so phone lines are wide open, and I'm happy to give you some guidance on anything you'd like. Let us, I had a question this week. Again, I'm not getting political, but a question, the words are being used, quid pro quo and extortion and bribery, and what are the differences, and why are these words, are they interchangeable? Is there some magic definition that has some different definition for all these three? And the best way I can describe it is that quid pro quo is not really a legal term necessarily. In the sexual harassment realm it is, which means I have to sleep with the boss in order to get a good job. That's quid pro quo. But in the world of impeachment, the world of law, in the world of criminal law, quid pro quo is not, it's sort of, it's not a bad thing. Quid pro quo could be good. You can say, let's say you're governor of Illinois, and you say to Chicago mayor, hey, mayor, if you hire more police officers, we will give you more money from the state. Well, you do this and I do that. That's good. It's good for both parties. And as long as you're not acting in a personal sense and you're doing something for the state and Lori Lightfoot is doing something for the city, then that's a good quid pro quo. That's something you can do. The problem with quid pro quo when it goes bad is that you're asking for something via your office. You're using your office to get a personal advantage. And we saw that with Rob Blagojevich, where clearly he was saying, put money in my campaign and then I'll give you the Children's Hospital, the $8 million that you need. That is illegal. Even if it doesn't happen, the threat of that and the idea that you're trying to do that is illegal. Extortion is, if you don't do something, I'm going to do something harmful to you. Bribery is, you need to do something for me, and I'll do something for you. So it's a slightly different thing. It's mostly money. I'll give you the zoning if you give me some money. Extortion is, if you don't do that zoning, I'm going to shut down your business. That's a slight difference, but that's the best way I can describe it. Let me give out the numbers again, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Don. Hi, Don. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you?
Hi, Karen. Good evening.
Good. What's your question?
So I was married for 9 years, and we got divorced 3 years ago. And in the divorce decree, the judge said that the credit that we shared, well, we really didn't really share it, when we got married.
Hi, Don.
Go ahead. I'm here. And I added her name to my credit card.
Okay.
Well, after being married 9 years, it didn't work out.
Okay.
And the judge decided that we would split the debt, which we did. And she kept paying the bills for about a year or two. And then she completely stopped.
Okay.
Now, it isn't the divorce decree that she has to pay this. However, like I said, the cards were in my name when we got married, and I did add her name as a signer to them.
Okay, so are you continuing to pay the debt, even the portion that she was ordered to pay?
I had to, because otherwise my credit would have been in the tank.
Okay. Yeah. And how much is it altogether that you paid on her behalf?
It was about, her half was 24. I got it whittled down to about 16 now.
Okay. So what you need to do is, you know, you can do it one of two ways. You can take her back to court now, or you can take her back to court when you've made the payments. Just keep good track of it. I would definitely be sending her a letter saying, you need to make these payments. You're not making these payments. I'm making these payments. The question is, you know, and maybe you hire a lawyer to write the letter and say, you know, you owe me $8,000 or $9,000. When are you going to pay it? And then you go back to court with the lawyer and you show that she should be held in contempt for not paying it. The fact that the judge found that she was able to pay that credit and she didn't will probably get her held in contempt. And the question is, what's the judge going to do? Probably not going to throw her in jail, but may have her pay on a monthly basis until she makes good on those payments to you. I'm going to have to run, but that's my best advice. Good luck to you.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. 981-7200, 981-7200. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. We are taking your legal questions here, 312-981-7200. That's to call and talk to me on air, which is fun. Or you can text 981-7200 and text your information to me. If for some reason you don't get through or you want to call me at the office during the week, it's 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me and give me some facts, where you live, what happened, when it happened, what you expect, and what your legal issue is, WGN at AskKarenConti.com, KarenConti. Let's go to Chuck. Hi, Chuck. Welcome to WGN.
Karen, good evening. This is a question about a personal trust here in Illinois. About 20 years ago, I had my first trust done, and then 10 years later, because of some of the beneficiaries either passing on or for whatever reason, I had some new beneficiaries added, and the new lawyer that I had redid the whole trust. Now it's another 10 years, and I'm wondering, do you have to redo the whole trust if you want to change beneficiaries? And for example, also if the executor has gotten too old and unable to handle the responsibilities, if you're just changing names, can that be done as a simple addendum page at the end, or does it have to be totally rewritten?
Okay, so I'm going to give you my best answer here. I'm not an estate planning lawyer, but generally speaking, I know a lot of lawyers don't like to do an addendum to a trust or a will that they didn't themselves draft. And here's why. Because they have a certain, you know, a lawyer has a certain way of saying things and providing for certain things. And frankly, in 10 years, the laws may have changed. And there may be other things that need to be put in there, or that the lawyer feels like it's really important that you make those changes. But you can certainly go to the lawyer that maybe did this trust 10 years ago and say, listen, I want to do this the cheapest way possible. I don't want a whole new will and trust. I want just an addendum that changes the following things, and see if the lawyer will do it. And if the lawyer says, no, I want to redo it, or you have a new lawyer, tell me why I need to redo it. And it could be as simple as the lawyer doesn't have the your document on Word, and so then has to redo it anyway because they'd have to retype the whole thing. So, you know, would they have to retype it? Would they just do a simple addendum that changes the beneficiary? I mean, you know what? The answer to your question is, it depends. You know, it's going to depend. But I think that if you walk in saying, this is what I want, then the lawyer will either listen to you and say, fine. And the lawyer might say, there's some change in the law that I think could help you. But if you don't want to do it, I may have you sign off kind of a waiver to say, I choose not to have this will and trust redone. I choose to have just an addendum, so that you understand that maybe it's beneficial to have a new will done, but you choose not to do that. So that's my best advice. And for everyone out there, good Chuck, I'm so glad you've got an estate plan. It sounds like you've had one for a number of years, and I think that's a very smart thing to do. If anybody ever needs a referral to someone who does this kind of work, I've got several in the community who are very good in different north and west and in the city, and I highly recommend that everyone do that and make that your New Year's resolution to get yourself an estate plan. Thanks for the call, Chuck. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Karen.
All right.
That was helpful.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Let's go to Barb. Hi, Barb. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you?
Hi, Karen.
Good.
Fine. How are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to follow up with what you told the last caller, and that sounded good, but I just wanted to add to it. I'm an estate planning attorney, and often what I like to do is called a restatement of trust, where we keep the same name of the trust, we keep the same date, so you don't have to rename everything with the investments and the real estate and all that, and we just basically change the contents. We say it's still this name of the trust and dated this date, but I'm changing it as follows, and you basically replace all the insides of it. You replace the guts, and it's called a restatement of trust.
That's great. Thank you, Barb. Thank you so much for that. That would be coming from someone who does this for a living, and I think that's a great, and I think, Chuck, maybe that's what you ask your estate planning lawyer, is a restatement of trust. Thank you so much, Barb. Take care, and happy
You're
holidays.
Welcome.
Thank you for calling.
You Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
And that's, you know, and that's great. That's great that she has that. Okay, let me go to the texts. My wife works for and recently interviewed somebody who didn't get the job. That person said my wife did not accommodate her special needs, even though there are several other people who have similar needs currently working for the company. The woman made false accusations, so my question is, can my wife sue this other person for libel? So I just wonder what happened here. So someone comes in for an interview. Your wife interviews her. She doesn't get the job. And she claims she didn't get the job, I'm probably paraphrasing this, because there was no accommodation of her special needs, whatever that was, whether she had a physical problem or she had a disease or she had something. First of all, your wife would have had to have known about the special need, and there had to have been, that was the consideration and not hiring her. My guess is there were probably other reasons that your wife didn't hire this person, and she was angry and said that this was because you didn't accommodate me. And the proof of the fact that your wife accommodates people with special needs is that there are other people employed who also have special needs, and that wasn't a factor in hiring or maintaining employment. So the person now is saying things. Now, to whom is she saying these things? The disgruntled non-employee is talking to the boss, is saying things online. That's the question. And is that defamatory? You know, it could be. It could be that if it's a false statement, not an opinion, but if it's a false statement saying she didn't hire me and she discriminated against me based upon my disability, is that liable? And it could be. The question is, what are you going to do about it? Right? What lawyer is going to take that on a contingency? Meaning, what lawyer is going to take that with no money up front paid by you and is going to litigate for 2 or 3 years in court and maybe get some money and split it with you? No lawyer is going to take that case. That's the problem. In order to sue for libel, you'd have to pay a lawyer by the hour to do it. And lawyers can be very expensive. It can be $200, $300, $400, $500 an hour to sue for what? Now, that said, you could hire a lawyer to draft and send a cease and desist letter saying you have said the following things. These are false. If you say them again, you'd be subject to the libel laws, and see if that will make that person back down. Just coming from the other standpoint, this person did not get hired. That's really a dumb thing to do. Sorry. If you're not hired by a company and you are making these allegations, let's just say that you don't have any basis for it. You just think that it's because of your special need. Well, word goes out in the community. I don't know what job this is or what like in the law, you think we have all these lawyers. We have 30, 40, 50,000 lawyers, and you think people aren't going to know. Well, people are going to know if she goes to another company that she is making these allegations and is saying things about the employer. So if you're not hired and you have a problem with it, you got to be very careful, because you don't want people to blackball you. I'm not saying don't assert your legal rights or don't get angry if someone is discriminating against you, but you've got to play it carefully, because what you really want is not a lawsuit. You want a job, and you want to keep your job. You want to get a job and keep a job. And this sounds like a bad situation for everybody. The answer to your question is your wife may have a lawsuit, but you're probably not going to be cost effective here to bring it. Let's see. This question is for Karen Conti. The Township Code states that trustees cannot be removed from office unless they commit a serious crime or a palpable omission. Could you please discuss what is meant by a palpable omission? I don't think that palpable omission has a legal term. You know, I would probably just revert to the dictionary. Omission is to not do something. Serious crime is obviously, you know, stealing, bribery, extortion, all the things we were talking about before. But an omission is failure to do something. And the word palpable is kind of extreme to the point of it being tangible. You know, something that's very serious and something that's clear on its face, that is so tangible that you don't need anyone to explain it. So a tangible omission would be, I don't know, like if you have a duty to file a yearly report as an auditor and you didn't file the yearly report, that might be a palpable omission, something that would be indisputable. But that doesn't really have a specific legal definition. I would just go to your dictionary. Let's see, what else? A year ago, a lawyer made a 2-page amendment to my dad's 25-year-old trust, making me the trustee instead of my dad, whose health was failing, and making my brother the backup trustee. Okay, and there's no question. All right, I don't know what that is. Okay, so all right. Oh, so I think this was in conjunction with the idea that there was an amendment to the trust as opposed to a new trust or a restatement of trust. So yes, again, some lawyers will do that as an amendment or an addendum. And according to Barb, the estate planning lawyer, we could do it as a restatement of trust. So there's all kinds of different ways and methods that you can do it. And obviously, you want to do it in a way that's most cost effective. And then let's see, Ben, do we have any more time or take a break? Okay, let's take a break and we're going to let's play a little quiz game. Okay, so let's go with the fifth caller. I'm going to continue to take your legal questions, so continue to please call. And then let's get someone on the line. We'll do a very quick quiz. 981-7200, 312-981-7200. Welcome back. We're going to be taking some legal questions here. Texter says, I have a friend who's an avid drug user. I never use this stuff and I've never been in trouble. If I were to get pulled over with my friend in the car, could I be in trouble if they are in possession of drugs, even if I didn't know they had it on them? Asking to see if I should quit giving them rides. I mean, technically, you're not in possession of it. They are in possession of it. But the problem is, in a car, you know, what if they have it out? What if it falls in the seat? What if they're using it in the back seat and you're not aware? This presents a problem. I mean, obviously, it's probably best not to get in the car with someone who has drugs, because you never know what's going to happen, especially if they're using drugs and they're not using their best judgment. And is that person going to throw you under the bus if the police come over and search them and find that they have drugs? Yeah, I got it from him. He's got it too. I don't know. It's just probably more of a common sense than a legal question. And the answer is probably you don't want to be driving around with them. Karen, love your show. I've been living in a large apartment building for 15 years. The building is managed by a company. Earlier, apartment people came in to get the market value. Now everyone got a check back refunding their security deposits. The letter said the owner wishes to refund the deposits, but we are still responsible for damages if we move out. What does this mean? Could they have sold the building? Are all the tenants going to be evicted? It sounds like the building has been sold. It sounds like the owner refunded those security deposits. Maybe, I'm not sure if he should have done that or not, or given them to the next landlord. But generally speaking, if you have a lease, that lease is good no matter whether or not the building was sold. So the new landlord buys the property subject to the leases that are already there. So just because there's a new owner doesn't mean they can breach the lease. But please understand that if you have 2 months left on your lease, the new landlords can come in and say, we're not going to renew. We're going to do something else. We're going to gut it. We're going to live there ourselves. So make sure that you know what's going on, and make sure your lease should be honored is the bottom line. But it could mean a change for you. Let's go to Annette. I'm going to do this as quickly as possible. Hi, Annette.
Hi, thanks, Karen, for taking my call. I have a question. After 100 days in a rehabilitation facility, my husband was getting stronger and better, and they said if I were to keep him another month at my expense, they could really rehabilitate him even more, get him stronger, so he would have a easier time when he comes home. And, well, It was very expensive. And I'm wondering if they were not looking out for his behalf because he came home and 2 months later he died. And I was wondering, is there any way I could recap some of that money that I gave them? It's quite a lot of money.
Yeah. You know, there's no guarantee. I'm going to put you on hold here because there's an echo. There's no guarantee, obviously, that they, you know, they said we can take care of him and maybe he can get better. That doesn't mean that they're going to guarantee his health. I know what you're saying. You're saying, as I never would have paid all that money had I known that he was going to pass on. And it just seems unfair that you had to pay it. I just don't think you're going anywhere with that claim. You can certainly write a nice letter and say that I paid all this money. You guys made this claim. I know you're not legally responsible, but, you know, is it possible for me to get some of this back? I think that's probably your best way to deal with it, because from a legal standpoint, you really don't have a lawsuit, unless they did something wrong, of course. Dave, welcome to the show. You have a question about alimony.
Yes, regarding legal separation. I've heard you talk about this in the past. For the purposes of keeping my spouse insured, I guess the question would be, is that a federal or state mandate, or is it company specific with the ability of keeping them insured? And then also, would I have to still pay alimony as you would in a traditional divorce?
Okay, so you're talking about a legal separation, and your question is, would that preserve your spouse's right to continue to get insurance with your employer?
Right. That's right. That's one of them.
Okay. So legal separations are very unusual. Legal separation is just like a divorce. You file in court. You do an agreement. You go to court. It's a formal process. You have full disclosure of assets. So it's not like you can just move out and that's called a legal separation. The people think that. It's not. It's a full divorce. And the only real reason to do it is this reason, which is maybe your spouse needs continuing coverage on the health insurance. And the only way to do that is for her to be part of that group is to stay married to you technically, but we call it a legal separation. And yes, the issue of alimony, if you have a legal separation, you could very well be obligated to pay alimony, we call it now maintenance, which is spousal support. If you are obligated to do that in divorce, you are probably obligated to do it in a legal separation. There's one thing that you need to know about this insurance issue. There's an act called the Illinois Spousal Legal Coverage Act, or it's all those four words are in the act, and they might be mixed up a little bit, but it's Spousal Coverage Insurance Act. And that says that before you get divorced, if you put your spouse and certain participating employers, you put your spouse on that insurance and you fill out a form, then when you get divorced, she can stay on that group policy even though you're divorced. But you have to make an affirmative application for it. And if you do it before you're divorced, you can kind of avoid the issue. You can get divorced. You can, you know, if that's what you really want to do, and keep her on that coverage, which is cheaper for her and probably a better situation for her as well. If you want to email me at the office, I can send you a copy. There's a one-page explanation of that act, which is very, very helpful and can help you through that. And I probably can send you a link to legal separation so you know the differences between divorce and legal separation. And I'll put you on.
Okay, what's the email address?
Okay. It's WGN@AskKarenConti.com.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. All right. Okay. I'll email you. Thanks, Karen.
Good luck. Good luck to you, Dave. All right. What do we even have time for my quiz? Do we have time? No. A little. Just a minute. Just a minute. You know what? 2 minutes. Okay. Here we go. John is going to be our contestant. Hi, John.
Hi, Karen.
Okay, we're going to do this fast, for as many as we can. This day in legal history, November 24th, I'm going to tell you what happened on the day, and then I'm going to ask you a question about the topic. Okay, so on this day in 1874, Joseph Glidden patented barbed wire. The Barbed Wire Museum is in La Crosse, Kansas. But where is Joseph Glidden's beautiful home in what Illinois city?
Okay.
I'll give you a hint. Northern Illinois University is in the city.
Northern Illinois University would be in...
Keep going west. You go west. You keep going. Aurora, west.
DeKalb.
DeKalb, Illinois. There you go. That's 1 point. 1871, November 24th, 1871, the National Rifle Association organized for the first time in New York City. What famous actor served as the president of the NRA from 1998 to 2003?
Oh, boy. It's the one who played the white hair guy.
Holy Moses.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of his name.
Charlton.
Charles Heston.
Charlton Heston. All right. And the 1963, the first live murder on TV was Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. Who is he defended at trial? True or false? It was F. Lee Bailey. Melvin Belli, and he was given the death penalty, but he died before he was able to be executed. John, thank you. I'm going to send you a prize because you did get two of them out of three, and I thank you for listening. I'm going to put you on hold and get the address. Thank you so much for listening. Have everyone have a very, very happy Thanksgiving from Karen Conti and WGN.